Welcome to episode 74 of Get Out Alive, a bi-weekly podcast about animal attacks, why they happen, and how we can avoid them. I'm your host, Ashley, and today is a very special episode. It's part one. We're doing a two-parter, so today's part one. I will let the guests introduce themselves in a moment, but before we get to that, I have two new expert survivalist patrons to shout out. Thank you so much to Michelle and Rebecca for joining our expert survivalist tier on Patreon. You can also join through the link in our episode description or at patreon.com/getoutalivepodcast. You can follow for free for just free bi-weekly posts that are relevant to recent episodes, or you can join for either $1, $5, or $15 a month to get different benefits for different tiers. And you can check that all out at the link in the episode description. But today's part one is a long time coming, and I will keep this short so we can get right into the episode. But I wanted to have today's guest on to talk about this topic because I think it's very important, especially because so many of you, which I love, contact us through social media and share videos, especially videos of people interacting with animals they maybe shouldn't be, like leopards or jaguars or bears. So today's episode is a case study, basically, of a very famous influencer, if you could say that, on TikTok, and the truth behind their videos, which is honestly disturbing. We will cover animal attacks, I promise, but I do think it is an important story for all of us to hear. So as we consume this content through TikTok or Instagram or Facebook, you might have a better understanding of what is actually going on behind the scenes and how we can, through what we consume on social media, contribute to better organizations that don't exploit these animals or cause active harm to the humans that take care of them. So without further ado, let's get into part one. So I am joined by a very special guest who has been on with us before, but we talked about something drastically different than what we're talking about today. So if you would like to introduce yourself and say why you're here, go ahead.
So hello, Ashley and fans. I am Sofyan Nasser, and I was on previously for talking about bats. But today I will be talking about something, as you said, very different. I am an ecologist, but back when I was still an undergrad, I took a investigative journalism class. Ooh. And I ended up going way deeper than my professor intended me to do on this one specific topic, which was about social media and exotic pets. And I ended up researching this one specific organization, and I use that term loosely. Technically, it's a 501c3, which is a nonprofit. Again, we're going to use that term very loosely.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yes. Tax returns, everything, those are all 501c3 for him. So to get into it, this is going to be an episode about Safari Sammy and Carl Bovard and their organization, Single Vision Inc. And you might have heard of Safari Sammy before. For a lot of animal lovers, the social media algorithms have recently been bringing up a lot of exotic animals like leopards, lions, bears. Savannah cats, bears all the time, raccoons. Oh, it's been like this influx. Like, I don't know if it's been the same for you.
Oh, it is. So first of all, people will send me videos of people with these pets. I'm not sure if people think that I want to see it and think it's cute or if people are like, can you believe this? Hopefully it's the second one. But it's fun. Every time I see a video of like a pet raccoon or someone feeding like opossums outside, I always hit like, don't show me anything like this. And they still keep coming. So I don't know what it is. I can't stop seeing these videos. But yeah, they come up for me all the time.
Yeah, so that's been the same thing that I've experienced. And I think it's true for a lot of like animal lovers, anything that, you know, ecologist adjacent, you start getting like inundated with wildlife videos, which is the opposite of what I want to see.
Yep, me too.
And one user kept popping up for me, which is Safari Sammy. She's super active on TikTok. She has 7.1 million followers.
Wow.
245.5 million likes, and she has a paid subscription and monetization on TikTok. She is active on like Instagram, but it's not quite to the same scale. So that's what I want to talk about today, is the man behind Safari Sammy, because Safari Sammy herself is actually just a volunteer at this organization.
She's only a volunteer?
I know, she's just a volunteer. So I don't know if she gets paid, but according to Florida Fish and Wildlife, she is a volunteer on paper.
Wow.
Their most popular volunteer, but still a volunteer, which we'll check out if we get into this. It's going to sound very on par for this organization. But to briefly introduce you to Safari Sammy herself, Samantha, and I'm not going to say her last name because I don't want any harassment towards her specifically, which I don't think your fans would do, but just in case.
I will say, when you first, because we've been talking about these people for, like, you and I for a long time, probably
a
year.
Yes, we have.
Now. Yeah.
Like, and 2 years.
It's been two. Oh, God. Time flies.
Yes.
So, like I said in last week's ep, this has been a long time coming because you were gathering so much information, like getting so many legal documents from the state about this. And when it first started coming up, especially after Tiger King, yeah, it was definitely around that time because I started seeing more and more of those accounts. And I would comment on Safari Sammy, on Doc Antle, the guy from Tiger King. And I would say things like, hey, you really shouldn't be promoting that petting a jaguar is a good idea. No matter what you say, if it is even slightly negative to them, you'll get blocked and unable to comment, and your comments will be deleted.
I have had to create so many alt accounts to do this research. It's not even funny.
Wow. Damn.
But so Samantha herself, she's in charge of the TikTok account. The owner of the organization, which is Single Vision, Carl Bovard, he runs the Facebook account as well as the publicly accessible Instagram. And when it comes down to it, this is really Carl's gig. You know, this is his organization. These are his animals. And Sammy is just somebody who has access to them and creating content with them.
Hmm.
So especially with her being a volunteer, I found that the story really wasn't with her. I thought it would be. I thought that it would be more like, okay, this woman who's Safari Sammy, this is her TikTok.
Yeah.
But it turns out it really is somebody other than who is posting, or at least who's posting to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
As it usually ends up being, it is a man behind the real issues.
Great.
Yes. I don't know if I should have said that either, but
hey, I'm all about it.
So let's jump right into it. I have 9 pages of notes here, and that is after condensing a lot of my research. So oh my get God. Your popcorn out.
I literally, if you're watching this, I literally have a tub that says popcorn, and I'm ready. I'm so excited.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the amount of records that I requested from either the USDA or Florida Fish and Wildlife has been extensive. At some point, I requested literally all of the Florida Fish and Wildlife records that they had. And the guy who emailed me back, he's like, that's a lot. You know, are you sure you want all of these? And I'm like, yes, I will genuinely pay you to do this. And I did have to end up paying like $30 or something for all the records.
Wow.
Just because of the time it took for them to go and like digitize some of them.
Oh boy.
But yeah. So let's just get started.
Woo.
Okay. So Safari Sammy in the past has not linked where she works. And in the past, she hasn't even been willing to mention, not saying that she commented and was like, I will not release where I work. But she would ignore comments when they asked, you know, where can I see these animals? Where do you work? How did you get this job? And she also didn't link anything in her bio, which I thought was weird because anybody who's worked in nonprofit sector, it's so valuable to have the amount of reach that she has on social media when it comes to donations, when it comes to education. that type of reach is unparalleled. And so not listing where she worked was kind of a red flag for me. And it ended up being pretty simple to find once you realized that you could just search for the names of the animals. So I was able to trace it back to Single Vision Inc. And then from there, I went into who owns these animals and how are they licensed. The USDA has a super awesome lookup tool that allows you to search any person that's registered through the USDA APHIS program. And so that's how I was able to find out that it's Carl Bovard who is running Single Vision, who is the man behind the organization. Once again, using that loosely. It's better described as a roadside zoo, and you'll see why soon. So who
is... Just a quick question.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, before you get into that. So what is... I don't know if you even know this, but like, what does it take to be a nonprofit?
I actually do know this. I founded my own nonprofit a while back, like when I was 14. Not related to conservation or wildlife at all. It was a senior dog rescue. But I know, right? But I do know it's pretty simple to get a 501c3. All you have to do is really have a good argument for why you are a nonprofit, why your efforts are for the good of the community.
Okay.
And in this specific case, Carl Bovard made the argument that he is a nonprofit entity because he is working towards conservation and education. And that is a weird one to argue, considering that Safari Sammy's TikTok feed has basically no education component to it.
Well, yeah. Like, what are you educating people about? What it's like to own these animals? Because that's what it seems like.
Yeah, despite the hashtag not a pet that Safari Sammy always includes on her videos, there's no discussion of these animals in the wild, the threats that they're facing in the wild, why you shouldn't own them as pets. In fact, most of the comments in her comment section are, oh my God, I totally want to own a jaguar. Oh my God, it's so cool that you can just touch them. Wow, they really are big house cats. And she doesn't say anything back to these people. Sometimes she'll just like the comment and move on. And it's like, you can't do that if you are genuinely trying to educate people about exotic animals, especially if you claim to be taking in these animals from abusive, neglectful situations where they were owned as a pet. So it doesn't check out. But as far as keeping that 501c3 status, you really just have to make sure that you're not creating a massive profit. You can pay your staff, you can pay yourself, but you just have to abide by the 501c3 guidelines, which to my understanding, he has. There's not a lot of publicly accessible information as to their income sources and their expenses beyond what's, you know, a typical tax return. So there's not a lot that I can go into there.
Okay.
Face value is he is a nonprofit. The IRS has not revoked that. So at this point, we have to assume that that's legitimate within those guidelines.
Okay.
Does not mean it's a legitimate conservation or education facility.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that a lot of people don't understand, is that there are not the robust guidelines that you would hope there would be to figure out if somebody is legitimately running a good sanctuary or a good nonprofit.
Yeah. I mean, even in making this podcast, I've come to learn, like, even the AZA, like the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, isn't as strict as I would like them to be, frankly. And not to crap on zoos or anything, but a lot of zoos also say that they're promoting conservation, but whether or not you are breeding like an endangered species doesn't mean that necessarily like you're going to actively be contributing to that species conservation in the wild. Now, I know a lot of zoos like do donate, and yes, they're creating like a genetic database, but these littler roadside zoos, like you called it, they are not contributing to conservation of these species. If anything, they're just breeding them to say that they have more, but it's not, kind of like we talked about in the last episode, they're not contributing to the betterment of the species. If anything, it's making it worse because you're like glorifying them as pets. So
exactly. And I'll get into that breeding standpoint a little bit later, because that definitely comes into play here in some big ways. But I agree. I've totally, especially the USDA APHIS, I've been disappointed at just how many violations somebody can accumulate with no consequences. And I think by the end of this, y'all will be in agreement that something is not going right here.
Yeah. Okay. So keep on going.
Let's get back on track. Well, we never went off track, but let's get back on who Carl Bovard is. So he started out after his earning an undergrad in biology or some adjacent area. He started out at SeaWorld, which you can make your own opinions on SeaWorld.
It's not looking good.
It's not looking good. And certainly at the time that he was, you know, working there several years ago, he's probably in his 50s, maybe late 40s. So at the time that he was working at it, I think that there were even more problems than there are now, debatably. But again, not a great start. And where he works next is even a worse start, because he decides to go work with carnivores at Jungleland Zoo, which is a now shut down facility that had its own slew of USDA violations. Before it shut down in 2001, it caused a media stir because their declawed lion escaped. So not a good environment to be trained to work with carnivores, especially because the big takeaway that Bovard had when he stopped working at this place was that he was not happy that he couldn't interact hands-on with the large carnivores.
Oh my God. Also, like, I don't know if we've ever talked about it before. I don't know why it didn't occur to me that people might declaw lions and big cats. That's awful.
Yes. So the USDA no longer allows the declawing of big cats, but that's only for facilities that are licensed through them. So private pet owners, if they can find a vet who can declaw and defang any of these large exotic predators, there's a good chance that they will.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's not surprising, because a lot of people, you know, they have these large predators and they try to take away the biggest threats, which would be the teeth and the claws, to make them more handleable. Which is, I mean, we talk about declawing and the horrible effects it has on domestic cats.
Can you touch on that a little bit? Because I don't think some people know about that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I used to work as a feline specialized vet tech. And declawing is one of those things that I think was acceptable for so many years that people just did it, especially because veterinarians used to recommend it in some cases.
Oh, God.
But basically, it's the amputation of the distal phalange, so the tips of the claws. Usually, it's done just on the front claws, because those are the ones used to, you know, claw furniture or whatever else people think is problematic. But sometimes it will be all four paws. So it's not just like clipping the fingernails or even like removing the fingernails. It is amputating like the first knuckle of your hand.
Yeah.
Except we don't stand on our hands. Cats stand on their hands and their feet. So all of their weight is going into these amputated digits, which causes not only a lot of pain, especially if it's been done improperly, but as they age, it can cause a lot of arthritis. And so it ends up, you know, we have our these declawed cats that end up entering the shelter system and rescue system at later ages, because maybe they're not using their litter box consistently because the litter hurts their already sensitive feet. Maybe they are biting because now that they don't have their claws, they go to the next, you know, defensive mechanism, which is their teeth. And cat bites, if you know, they are not pleasant. They tend to inject a lot of bacteria through very small bites, which can become infected very easily. So even in the cases where cats are declawed because they live with an old person and they have fragile skin and, you know, those claws can cause bleeding really easily, the alternative is that you get a cat that bites now. And that's even more dangerous. And so even public health organizations don't recommend declawing cats. Public health organizations probably wouldn't agree with declawing large predators or having them at all, because as we will talk about, it is a direct threat to your health. As you talked about in the last episode, not a great thing for your continued well-being and survival. So declawing big cats is just as bad, if not worse, than declawing domestic cats. Oftentimes it will be done improperly, and you will be having, instead of a cat that claws you, a giant 500-pound cat that will bite you, and that is much worse.
Yeah, I mean, even if they take away the fangs, they still have an entire mouthful of other teeth. So
exactly. Yeah, and it's, they have strong jaws. They have, I mean, it's just, I don't think people realize how massive and strong large cats actually are. Yeah. You know, playfulness can devolve into something else really quickly, even by accident. Yeah. So after leaving Jungleland, he ended up acquiring two tigers of his own, Amira and Bali. And he acquired them as cubs. I can't tell you whether or not they were declawed. The fact that it was an acceptable practice at the time, and the fact that he would declaw one of his older jaguars, makes me think that it's possible. But again, I don't want to speculate in this episode. I would just suggest that it's a possibility. So with these two cats, Amira and Bali, he began taking them to venues like flea markets, and he would have them pose with the public for paid pictures. And this is when he registered with the USDA, because he was publicly showing these cats. And with that, this is also when he got his first USDA violation, because he failed to ensure adequate barriers between Amira and Bali and the public. So they were allowed to, at first, or at least a few times, to gain this USDA violation, the public was allowed to basically sit with them without a barrier involved, maybe even without a harness or restraint. The USDA violation that this specifically refers to requires that a barrier of some sort, so like a fence, an adequate harness that would keep them back if something did happen. And for a harness to work, it has to not be attached to a person, because what is a person going to do when a, you know, 500, 600 pound lion decides that they want to go for somebody? Nothing. So for some reason, there was not an adequate barrier. In addition, he also got into trouble for walking the tigers on a leash back and forth between the trailer and the photo booth. And I believe that this leash was actually a chain. Bovard has shown photos and videos walking his tigers on a chain. I guess a chain would help keep you attached to the line that's dragging you away, or the tiger.
Like, do you loop the chain around their neck and then the rest is just leash?
No, so this is like a chain that is attached to a collar.
Okay.
And then attached to a hand that is holding these tigers.
You know, not that I'm saying that you should walk a tiger on just a collar and a leash, but like, just from a standpoint of usefulness, I feel like holding a chain does not give you a lot of grip if you're trying to hold something back.
I wouldn't think so. I think that part of it is, maybe the image of a tiger on a chain is a little more appealing than, you know, finding a really secure leash. Again, I don't know what either is going to do for security of the tiger.
Yeah.
If it's going to bite through a leash, okay. It would probably, you know, rip through whatever's holding the chain. Unless you are chaining them to something other than a person. In which case, sure, that might be a better way to ensure that they don't chew through a tether. I don't know.
That's fair. That's a good point.
Either way, not great.
No, bad.
And you're definitely not supposed to do it according to the USDA. And I'll loop back to the tiger walking in further USDA violations. But for now, I want to, you know, rapidly go forward and to Bovard today. Today, Bovard runs Single Vision Inc. So that is located in Clay County, Florida. The address is publicly accessible. If you go to Google Maps, type in Single Vision Inc., it'll come up. I suggest turning on the satellite view and seeing where it's located, because you'll notice it's very close to other homes. This is a 10-acre property, which, considering he has at least 95 animals, 15 New Guinea singing dogs, 2 gray wolves, 7 Syrian brown bears, including hybrids, 5 cougars, 10 lions, 2 jaguars, 6 tigers, 1 striped hyena, and 1 black bear. And those are just the largest carnivores that he has that I just mentioned. He has so many other animals that add up to at least 95 on the last USDA tally. 10 acres is not sufficient.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm just, as you were saying that, I looked up the address and I'm looking at all the Google reviews and the pictures of people in the cages with the animals. Yes. He has a coati here. Like,
yes,
it is. That is really disturbing to me.
Yes.
But, and
it's amazing. I think he has like 3.5 Google like stars on his Google reviews. I'm surprised that it's that high, but in those Google reviews, you will find some bad reviews that do comment on the size of his cages and the proximity that the enclosures are to each other, which is by necessity. He has 10 acres, over 95 animals. Although, to give him credit, you know, many of those animals are put in with each other. So, you know, he is consolidating.
Yeah, you know, he's making the most of his space.
Yes. Ugh. And the best thing is, you know, he's being careful to put, you know, different species together with other species that they're not supposed to be with. So we'll get into that too. It's a very interesting cohabitation. Actually, let's get into that now.
Like, yay!
So Bovard acquires most of, if not many of, his animals as babies, as cubs. And I think that this is a common practice within this type of organization. If you acquire them as babies and bottle feed them, they tend to be more handleable than when they're acquired later in life. That also is a nice bonus when it comes to cub petting, because you can have a cub that you're training up to be more handleable, and the public can be allowed to come in and hold slash pet these cubs. So in Florida, you can have cub petting events up to 40 pounds for large class 1 predators, which are, you know, includes bears, lions, tigers, that sort of thing, and hyenas, which we'll get into, because that was his most recent cub, was a young hyena that he's been allowing petting through COVID too. And hyenas are vulnerable to COVID, so that was great.
Wow.
And those are in some of those Google reviews that you'll see. There's just cub petting photos all over.
Sorry, when did he acquire the hyena?
So that was about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago. At the time that I wrote my original Twitter thread on this, Jaws, which is the hyena, was still being exhibited for cub petting. And that was like March 22. And so Jaws is no longer available for public contact, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so far he has not acquired a new cub that might be related to the big cat legislation.
Yeah. Do you want me to get into that a little bit right now?
I would love for you to do that. And then I will jump back into cohabitation and cub petting.
So the reason I was asking about the hyena is because, so like we talked, if you haven't listened to last week's or 2 weeks ago episode, maybe listen to that first, because I talk about the Big Cat Public Safety Act a bit more. But the Big Cat Public Safety Act was passed in December of 22. So that's why I was asking, because this act specifically bans the breeding and petting of big cats. I listed the species 2 episodes ago. I won't do it now. But according to the Big Cat Public Safety Act, which went into law in December of 22, so he had got the hyena before this, but I'm sure he knew it was coming. His organization and every other organization similar to his, if we're going to call it an organization, can no longer breed big cats, and you can no longer let the public have hand-to-hand contact with them. This also means he cannot acquire any more big cats. So
interesting.
So what he's got, in theory, according to the federal law, if he does it legally, those will be the last cats he will own. However, this act does not cover bears. It does not cover hyenas. So I wonder if he is delving into hyenas because he knows that that's a workaround from the big cats.
Yeah, that is so interesting. So just to clarify, so he is not able to breed any of the cats that he has right now. Is that
the idea?
Okay. Yep. And then is he able to acquire transferred animals then?
That's a good question.
Let me see. If he goes along with this whole like sanctuary, rescuing animals from other places or having animals transferred to his facility, I'm curious what the workarounds are, because I'm sure there are.
So there are exceptions, one of which may apply to him. So like colleges that have like or a state licensed vet can have them. There's some qualifying wildlife sanctuaries that can meet the requirements for the act. Qualifying transporters, but only when in custody of any big cat, solely for the purpose of expeditiously transporting the big cat to a person who qualifies for an exception. But the one that I think applies to him is an entity exhibiting animals to the public under a Class C license from the USDA or a federal facility registered with the USDA that exhibits animals, if the entity or facility holds a license or registration in good standing and meets all the requirements of the act for the exception. So he might get an exception. He would have had to qualify for that by now because there was a time period that they had to meet. But so you do need to notify the USDA or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service if your cat has died or if there is a change in location and changes to methods to prevent breeding and prevent direct contact with the public.
Interesting. Yeah, I would be curious to, I think, and I think we'll see this, as roadside zoos and some of the less reputable organizations start to develop workarounds, because I think that that's an inevitability when it comes to this type of organization and this type of pet trade, is that people will figure out how to skirt those rules.
Yeah, I also want to clarify too.
Yeah.
Sorry. I also just want to clarify too, they also cannot sell their animals. So you were asking about like, could he trade? I bet you could trade or like give them to somebody, but you legally can't sell them. So whatever that means, how they can work around that might be a little easier, but.
Yeah. So actually, to go off of that, looking through some of his acquisition forms, all of the animals are quote unquote donated. So even when they come to him as cubs, and a lot of them are coming to him from these organizations that resemble his a lot, where you go to their website, they have all these people petting these, you know, maybe a Savannah cat or a serval or, you know, animals that are not meant to be pet. So I think it is a very close circle, where animals are kind of traded and donated and dispersed. So not great, but it is nice to know that he will no longer be able to breed the big cats, because in the past, that has been one of his stated goals. He has Sita, S-I-T-A, however that is pronounced. She was one of his older jaguars who he actually got cited by the USDA for declawing after they banned declawing. He stated that he didn't know that there had been a change. That would have been something that, you know, somebody who is licensed under the USDA, you should probably keep on top of those types of regulations so that you don't get cited and fined. But he, back on his Facebook page, stated that he was breeding her with a male jaguar from another facility. This was several years ago. I believe Sita has now passed away. And this was true also of Amir and Bali, his first two tigers. They have also since passed away at, I think they were 18. So pretty old tigers, as far as I'm aware. So he has also talked about wanting to breed Tank, which anybody who's familiar with Safari Sammy, you're going to know Tank. Tank is their very overweight jaguar. And when I say very overweight, like, this is just one of the things that comes up in all of the comments. They're like, oh my gosh, he's so chonky. Oh, he's so round. And he is, like, he is a very large jaguar. And when we talk about red flags about facilities and social media, look for if the cats or any of the animals actually are in good condition. And this means they are not overweight or underweight. I think people look for underweight when it comes to abuse and neglect, but overweight, obesity in these animals is just as neglectful and abusive. So let's not, you know, love the chonk when it comes to wild animals. It's not good.
Also domestic animals for that.
Also too. Yes.
Yeah. Like, yes. Just because you see a like chihuahua that's 20 pounds, like, that's a problem. They are not getting the right exercise. Yeah. So that would be like an indication to me that either they're not getting the proper diet, like they're getting too fatty of foods, or they're just not given enough space to exercise. So those are two very important things on top of being fed. Like, cool, they're being fed, but you also need those other things too. So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, talking about breeding, he has also bred the bears. So he has Honey and Bruiser. Bruiser is an 8-year-old Syrian brown bear, and Honey is a 8-year-old North American black bear. They have been housed together at least some part of the time. I've seen them housed in other areas in the USDA notes, but they have been allowed to breed. And so far, they have produced Echo, Danger, Brutus, Wrigley, Ted, and Pooh, which are all hybrids. And I went out after seeing this and asked on Twitter, where I have, you know, a several bear experts, if anybody knew more about the hybridization of these two, because this is not something that would happen in the wild, obviously. Syrian brown bear does not overlap with the North American black bear. But we have heard of some places where grizzly bears and black bears have overlapped and very, very infrequently bred, because grizzly bears and black bears do not like to overlap. Black bears are a lot smaller. They can be killed very easily by grizzly bears and brown bears in general. So I was hoping to see if I could find any information about what housing these two species together could potentially do for, like, mental well-being, if it's a stressor to have, you know, a North American black bear with such a bigger bear.
Yeah.
I wasn't able to find anything, just because it doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen in facilities where good research is being done. And also the hybrids, they don't happen where good research is being done either. So there's not a lot known.
Yeah. You know, when you were saying that, I was sitting over here seething, because if an organization is telling you, like, oh yeah, we're about conservation, and they're making ligers and they're breeding black and brown bears, that's not for conservation. Those animals aren't supposed to exist, have nowhere to go if they were to be put in the wild. There's no conservation knowledge you can gather from making hybrids that wouldn't naturally happen. So there's no point to that. And then also, if you go to a real zoo, like an ASA-accredited zoo, like, I don't know, the San Diego Zoo, for example, a really good zoo, you don't see chimpanzees with orangutans. You don't see polar bears and grizzlies together. Like, there's a reason that only some animals, like, I don't know, maybe a rhino and some bird species. Yeah, those can live together. That might happen in the wild and they can get away from each other. But like, you don't see lions and tigers in the same exhibit for a reason. That's insane. And then to breed them is even crazier to me.
Yeah, exactly. And as you said, you know, there are some animals that can cohabitate pretty easily. Usually those aren't predators that are, you know, put together. You know, you'll see tigers housed with other tigers. Usually it's breeding pairs. Tigers are pretty solitary otherwise. But yeah, Bovard has, and I'll list these off to you. We have had noted in the USDA inspection results, or noted in the USDA inspection notes, they have tiger bear, tiger lion, which again, potential for a liger there, cougar leopard, caracal lynx, Syrian brown bear, black bear. And then on their TikTok, we've seen two juvenile lions housed with a cougar, a juvenile cougar. And that was especially concerning just because of the sheer size difference between those two species. Yeah. Even as juveniles, there was a big size difference between Cheyenne, who was the juvenile cougar, and Tima and Vati, who were two juvenile lions. They have since been moved out of cohabitation. Now Cheyenne is cohabitating, I think, with another cougar. And Tima and Vati are now cohabitating with other lions to form a lion pride, which is something that we'll talk about. His continued acquisition is something we'll talk about. But there was a lot of concerning behavior that wildlife experts noted on the TikTok videos that showed Cheyenne, Tima, and Vati interacting.
Yeah.
And then Tank and Binta are a very popular pair on the TikTok account that they have, which is an adult female lion and the adult male jaguar. So lots of different cohabitations occurring. That can be one of the biggest red flags when you're looking at social media. Look at what type of cohabitation they have. There should not be big cat cohabitation between different species.
Or bear and big cat.
Or bears and big cat. Isn't that crazy?
Never would I ever think to put those together.
And, you know, sometimes people will say, well, they're bonded. Like, there's been circumstances where sanctuaries have gotten a bear and a big cat. I think that there was a famous pair, or I'm sorry, a triple, I almost said thruple. Good Lord.
There was a famous thruple.
There was a famous thruple. Actually, I'm going with it. There was a famous thruple where it was a tiger, a lion, and a bear that were from a roadside zoo, and they had been bottle raised together. They had lived together all their lives, and the sanctuary didn't separate them because they felt that it would be a greater stressor to separate them than it was to keep them together. And that can be debated. But the key difference here is that Carl gets his animals as cubs for the most part. There are adults that he takes in, but they're not the majority. Mm-hmm. And these animals, he is cohabitating them intentionally with other different species. They are raised with other species to be housed with other species. For example, the hyena that he got, he raised that in his house with his dogs, with wolf hybrids. He introduced the hyena to tigers and lions through the fences. You can go on his TikTok and see all these different like play groups where they take them out to the pool that they have and let the wolves play with the lion cubs. And I mean, it's just...
Can I, just from the standpoint of a biologist, when we're talking about letting wolf Wolf hybrids are a whole other thing that deserves its own episode. Wolf hybrids should not exist and are so, they just shouldn't exist, period. Anyways, that aside, wolves with hyenas with big cats, because these are such drastically different species that have different bodies, let alone different behaviors, they don't have the same style of play.
No, like definitely they, not.
No, like, I mean, dogs have to physically, like when they are younger, learn how to play with other dogs. But it's not like, I mean, my cat and my dog may play, but it's not like wrestling. I have seen cats and dogs wrestling before. But they're domesticated species. We're talking about wild animals that in the wild would never play with each other because their versions of play may be so different. So I don't know how ethically, if you are an owner of these quote unquote pets, that you could feel comfortable letting them play with each other without knowing that they might eat each other. It's not, a lion could eat a hyena. That is not a thing that is like out of the realm of possibility. Like, some of them are prey items for each other. I just, yes. I don't know why you would want to put that risk towards your animals that you seem to care about.
Well, and that's exactly it. And it's just, there's so many different languages that go on between these animals that it's not, there's no translator. There's no way to say, oh, this animal is playing, but the way that it's playing, that makes this animal interpret it as a threat. I mean, this can happen where, you know, you're putting, I mean, lions and hyenas overlap in the wild and they don't overlap as friends. It's the same with bears and wolves. It's the same with grizzly bears and black bears. All of these events where you overlap these animals, it opens up the opportunity for a lot of damage. I mean, it's like allowing a baby, a human baby, to interact with a wolf. It's two very different languages. Even if the wolf wants to play for some weird reason, wolves play with their mouths, and in those mouths they have some really sharp teeth. That's not how those, you know, it's just not an overlap. I mean, it's as different a baby and a wolf as it is a bear and a wolf, as it is a, I mean, it's just a completely different language. Yeah, and that's a really good point. I think we're going to have to move into the USDA violations now because we just, again, we're on page 2 of 9.
Sorry, I'm so fired up about this.
I know. No, I am too. I genuinely can go on forever about this and possibly might go on forever. But let's go on to USDA violations. So Bovard has accumulated 51 violations from 20 total inspections or attempted inspections. And I say attempted because he has missed quite a few inspections. Let me see if I can find how many he's missed. So, Bovard has accumulated 51 USDA violations from a total of 20 total inspections or attempted inspections. And I say attempted because he has missed six inspections, which is impressive considering he lives there on the property. He has had 5 critical violations, and a critical violation is defined as a non-compliant violation that had a serious or severe adverse effect on the health and well-being of the animal. He has had 2 direct violations, and a direct violation is a critical non-compliance that is currently, at the time of inspection, having a serious or severe adverse effect on the health and well-being of the animal. 40 non-compliant violations, 4 teachable moments, which are violations that weren't enough to be non-compliant, but were enough to be noted. And that's a lot. It's not unusual to get a violation, an occasional violation. To have 1 or 2 in your history is not unusual, even if you are a really good facility. Having worked with animal regulatory agencies in the past, it can be really easy, even if you're doing everything right, to miss one particular thing or have one mess up on your paperwork or just be having a bad day when you're inspected. So that in itself is not unusual. It is very unusual to have 51 violations. For comparison, Joe Exotic had 43 violations. And I would like to point out, he did not have any direct violations. He did have 7 critical violations. And that was from 23 inspections and up to 155 animals.
This guy's worse than Joe Exotic? That's crazy.
At least when it comes to actual USDA violations.
Wow.
So he did, I mean, Joe Exotic did get shut down due to his violations, but it wasn't from the USDA, I don't think. I did not watch Tiger King because I know myself and I know that I do not have that in me to, to watch that. But I got the gist.
I will say,
to give like a non-terrible example, the Wild Animal Sanctuary, which is a pretty well-established organization, they have up to 345 animals and they've only had 10 violations.
Wow.
From 24 inspections. And that's still more than most organizations, I would say. I've looked at animals or sanctuaries like Wildcat Ridge. They've had maybe 2 violations.
Wow.
So it's not unheard of to get a violation, is my point.
Yep.
But it is a very bad sign when you have that many, especially that many critical or direct violations.
And it also shows that you're not improving over time. Like, you're still accumulating more and more. So it's, you're not learning your lesson when you're getting these violations, if you're having that many.
Exactly. And a lot of these are actually chronic violations. So he has gotten hit for the same violation over and over. And we'll go into that, but it is, it's a lot. So the way that I've divided these violations up, and I've included violations from Florida Fish and Wildlife, I've divided it into threats to human health, which includes to himself, threats to animal health and well-being, and then repeated violations and criminal charges.
Oh, boy. All right, I'm getting my popcorn again.
Yes.
I'm buckling up.
We've had to section them out is the takeaway here. So let's talk about public contact laws to begin with. So for Florida, you can have no public full contact in which the handler maintains proximate control, but not full control, with class 1 cats weighing more than 25 pounds. Incidental contact, such as the handler maintains control, but you're allowed to pet the animal, is not allowed for class 1 carnivores, including bears, that weigh more than 40 pounds. So his first violation for endangering the public occurred in 2006, and that was that failure to protect Bali and Amira, from the public and from the public, His first violation for endangering the public occurred in 2006, and that was when I mentioned earlier for failing to have an adequate barrier between Bali and Amira and for walking them on leash. His next was in May 2007, when a 19-year-old volunteer who was walking Bali was bitten and required stitches on his forearm. In 2010, he was cited for walking tigers outside the perimeter fence of his property. And again, I will emphasize, this is a 10-acre facility that is in very close proximity, within half a mile, if not within 0.3 or even less, from a residential house. And then a little further away is a full-on subdivision neighborhood. So walking those tigers outside of the perimeter fence means that's basically a loose tiger at that point. What is a person with a chain attached to them going to do to stop a full-grown tiger from bolting off? I mean, that's a different level of public endangerment.
Also, not to mention, like, not even the threat of the tiger, but this is something I think we talked about a bit with Oliver Starr in our very early episodes when we were talking to him about his wolves. When he's walking his wolves, sometimes dogs run at him.
Yes.
How are you going to stop a dog that's trying to attack your tiger? Like,
that's such a good point.
There's so much room for conflict there. Anyways.
Yeah. I will say that on TikTok, we have seen Sammy walking tigers on leash with no visible enclosure or fencing. That is not to say that this is definitive proof that he is, you know, violating this. It very well could be that he is within the perimeter fence when he's doing this. But I think it's worth mentioning that he has videos out there of him walking either Bali or Amira on leash without visible enclosures. Then in January 2012, a local news anchor, Bruce Hamilton, and his girlfriend were allowed to interact with Samson, an adult tiger. Hamilton then posted photos onto his professional, like, news anchor Facebook, which the USDA did not like. That resulted in law enforcement being set out, and Bovard had to give a statement. Hamilton had to give a statement. Basically, Bovard said that Hamilton and his girlfriend were personal friends and not members of the public, and that he does not, in capital letters, underlined twice, allow any members of the general public to ever have contact with a cat here that is over 40 pounds. We will see from the USDA reports that this is not true. But I would like to point out that there really doesn't seem to be a good definition of personal friend versus the public. For me, I would think nobody is able to access these animals that are licensed for public exhibition. This is a USDA. This is not somebody who just has a tiger. This is a USDA facility. And having personal friends being allowed to interact with these animals, I don't think that that's a good limit between public, personal friends, family members. I mean, if you have trained volunteers, if you have trained staff that have all gone through a certain amount of licensing, fine.
Yeah.
But what's to stop you from being like, oh, I met this guy just now. We're personal friends. Come on into my enclosure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he didn't seem to face any real consequences from that. There were no charges filed. Hamilton went out and clarified that this was not something that the public could do, even though he did it. But the USDA definitely was not happy with it. 2 years later, in April 2014, a member of the public was allowed to hold a bear cub, which was said to be 14 to 15 weeks old, 18 to 22 pounds. And this was either Honey or Bruiser. I can't be sure which one. They were both cubs at the time, and they were the only bears that he had. This member of the public was bit, and it broke skin and drew blood after she was told that she could hold the cub and allow it to suckle on her fingers multiple times. Bovard stated that the bear cubs had bitten members of the public and or volunteers at least two other times. I'm assuming that they didn't draw blood, so they were minor incidents that weren't reported. This is all from the USDA incident report. On May 6, 2014, he made a Facebook post seemingly about this incident, stating that, I have dedicated my life to the animals in my care, and if anyone tries to confiscate or euthanize one of my animals because of the ignorance of some idiot visitor or government official who thinks there's a risk of rabies or disease, they will have a fight on their hands. And I see your face at that, and yeah. That was also my face reading that.
Yeah, you know, it's not really a good sign when you're threatening, first of all, people who are, I'm assuming, paying to come hold your animals.
Paying a not insignificant amount of money, too.
Oh, boy. This is where you're getting your money. So you're calling these people stupid for the animal that you are responsible for doing exactly what that animal does. Because... So, once again, if you listen to our last episode, I talked about how I'm in like a wildlife law class, and there are many court cases about this specific thing that we're talking about. And there was one court case, I can't remember the exact year that it was, but basically there was an Asian elephant at a circus who got loose from its trainer, knocked over a like setup, and hurt a woman and her dog. I can't remember if it killed the dog or not, but it definitely hurt the woman. And basically, the guy who owned the elephant was like, oh, well, it wasn't my fault that she got hurt because, like, the elephant didn't necessarily, like, directly hurt her. And the court found that, like, if anyone gets hurt by your animal, even if a tiger, they said this, the judges said this as they, like, in their opinion, even if a tiger jumps on somebody and causes someone to have a heart attack out of fear, that is your responsibility because your animal caused it. I don't care if a person stuck their hand through the cage and then the bear bit them because of it. And yeah, it was their fault. It's still your bear. Like, you are still responsible for that animal. So don't say that it's their fault that they're idiots because the bear did the thing that you told them to do. Sorry.
Yes. That's it. No, I absolutely agree. And I think that that post was the result of probably either local Florida officials coming in and wanting to put the bears under some sort of quarantine. Because when you have a exotic animal or wild animal bite, there is the concern of rabies, especially if they haven't been vaccinated against rabies. I don't know the vaccination schedule of bear cubs. I worked in cat medicine, not bears, and I will continue to be glad for that. But I imagine that that's what happened, and that's what resulted in him coming out strong. And this was strong. I would not personally want to risk enraging a bitten visitor by calling them an idiot because I was upset. I mean, they could have sued, and I don't think they did.
Yeah, it's bad business.
It's bad business. So we're going to jump ahead to 2019 here, not to say that there weren't violations in the middle here, but there were a lot, and we only have a short amount of time. I'm already running way over. So buckle in. So Florida Fish and Wildlife had a report that a gray fox wearing a collar had wandered into a neighborhood that was somewhat in close proximity to Single Vision. And it took about 2 days before they could figure out who the fox belonged to. But when they called Bovard and said, "Hey, there's a fox, is it yours?" Bovard said the fox was already back and had been secured. And he sent a photo of the fox at his facility to the officer. He explained that the fox had escaped the evening of February 16th and was recovered the next morning after digging a hole in the corner of its enclosure. And he was issued a warning, but not any citation for this. This escape kind of is a good example of why the USDA and Florida Fish and Wildlife are valid in their concern when they are citing him for issues regarding wobbly or sagging enclosure fences, things leaned up against the perimeter fence, broken latches, broken locks, and a whole host of other things like tree branches, tree limbs being too close to the enclosure or proximity fence. The chance of a large predator escaping is not zero when you have those conditions. It's not even zero when you have perfect conditions. And considering how close he is to neighbors and people who are completely uninvolved in this whole venture, there's some pretty serious concerns there. We'll go forward to 2020. So between July 2020 and January 2022, and I want you to remember how previously when he was cited for the news anchor interacting with his adult tiger, how he said that he did not allow the public to come into contact with any big cats over 40 pounds, not being capitalized and underlined. So in this period of time, 31 members of the public posted photos and or videos of direct interaction without restraint or barrier with juvenile over 12 week old and adult lions, jaguars, bears, and combinations thereof, thanks to the cohabitation that he has in the enclosures. They saw bear cubs nipping at clothes, hands, and hair. In one case, one bear cub took a good hold of somebody's clothes, is what the USDA report writes. A member of the public was allowed to touch the muzzle of an adult male bear through the enclosure. This also included adolescent children interacting with two juvenile lions, again, over 12 weeks old. And then, yeah, just allowing them to go into enclosures or pose with adult lions, jaguars, and bears. So not exactly sticking to what he said. Then between October 2022 and May 2023, six members of the public posted photos and or videos that APHIS deemed to show them interacting with smaller exotic animals in a way that wasn't safe for the public and or animal, which included children holding a juvenile silver fox, an adult serval, and a ring-tailed lemur, or feeding them. So not only did he not learn from the previous encounters with the USDA finding his publicly posted photos and or videos, he allowed it to continue with smaller exotic animals. There's a possibility that he could have allowed it to continue with the larger predators and carnivores, but didn't have them posted publicly. That is for y'all to interpret whichever way you would like. Bovard also stated that the facility occasionally uses volunteers with previous exotic animal experiences and allows former or current employees of other USDA-regulated facilities, his family members, personal friends, and exotic animal exhibitors to interact with the animals without documentation. And this is how he was trying to explain the photos and videos that were shown of members of the public interacting with these large animals. The USDA noted that he had no documentation of responsibilities, training, or experience handling dangerous animals or volunteer agreements for these volunteers. One thing that did stand out during this report was that one of the most frequent volunteers was identified by the licensee as a veterinary student at the local CVM, University of Florida, and had a provisional permit to work under the licensee's state permit. After speaking with admissions at the local CVM, this individual was identified as an undergraduate pre-veterinary student with no formal veterinary training. This is likely referring to Sammy, who has previously discussed her desire to pursue a veterinary degree, but is not yet enrolled in the veterinary college, as far as I know. And this is not the first time Bovard has referred to Sammy as a veterinary student in USDA documentation. So, good to know. I'm now going to move into threats against the APHIS USDA officials. So on one notable incident on March 17th, 2020, Bovard conducted himself in a threatening manner throughout the inspection that interfered with USDA officials to conduct a complete inspection. Additionally, he would not allow inspectors to take pictures. And this one, I think, is worth reading a longer quote from the USDA report. So I'm going to go ahead and do that.
Yeah.
Throughout the duration of the routine inspection, inspectors experienced argumentative, sarcastic, intimidating, harassing, and aggressive behavior with the licensee. His body language demonstrated an increase in agitation with every observation made by inspectors. He stood cross-armed, quivered his lip, and continuously wrung the neck of a drinking bottle. Inspectors felt too intimidated to take pictures of non-compliances observed, concerned his anger would grow further. The inspectors discussed their findings and justifications for citations with the licensee. After complaining that none of the animals were injured and said the citations were unwarranted, he stated he would appeal the citations. The home inspector stated that she would need to take pictures of the non-compliances. The licensee abruptly stated, "No, your inspection is over." The home inspector stated that she could see he was visibly upset and promptly left the facility. So that was an interesting report to read, especially because like the action item that USDA listed was inspector or the licensee is to conduct himself properly with inspectors. And it's like, okay, how protect your inspectors? Like,
yeah. And also like, how can he tell them, no, you're done inspecting my facility? They're the ones that grant you the right to have these animals. How can you say that?
Exactly. And I don't know. This was one of the big inspection reports that made me wonder, how on earth is he allowed to continue holding a USDA license?
Yeah.
I mean, acting aggressively against the inspectors who are the that's the representation of the USDA there. How is that allowed? And one thing that I will ask over and over again is, at what point do they revoke a license? And so far, I have not found that limit, because there's a lot of violations that have been critical violations, in that they endanger the health and welfare of either the animals, of the public, or of the inspectors, and nothing has been done to revoke that licensure.
Yeah, you know, I totally forgot when we talked about this years ago now. I forgot I actually reached out to APHIS and asked, like,
oh, right. What?
Yeah. And I never really got a good answer from them, unfortunately. So,
yeah.
Do you want me to go through my questions?
Oh, yeah. Please do. That would be great.
Okay. Sorry. I totally forgot what I asked. So what I actually did ask them about this, and I said, if an animal care, because that's like the branch of APHIS that does this inspection. So I said, if an animal care employee is inspecting a facility and the owner of said facility becomes belligerent and refuses to let the inspector do their job, what action is taken after that? And they just said, that can be answered in our book of regulations and our animal welfare inspection guide, and just linked that. And almost every single answer just linked me to the rules and regulations. And I said, can an owner be fined or shut down for refusing inspection? They said, oh, that's also explained in our book of regulations. I said, how many citations does it take to shut down a facility? They said, there isn't a set number that causes a shutdown. It's a process. In addition to our book of regulations, this process is included in our enforcement process here. And yeah, they just basically say, just check out our rules and regulations. It wasn't helpful to me at all.
Yeah, that's been most of my interactions with USDA as well. It takes a while to get answers, and the answers that you get are unsatisfying.
Yep.
I've also reached out to Florida Fish and Wildlife about what they regard as reason to shut down a facility, because they have just as many instances of violations as the USDA does. And they're the only ones who have actually taken criminal charges up against him, which we will get into. But I have not gotten responses. So moving on to injuries against himself, injuries or threats, I should say, because one thing is that he keeps animals in his personal residence. Florida Fish and Wildlife specifically stated that he had animals such as two juvenile hybrid bears and a juvenile hyena that had lived in his house that should have been moved outside when they exceeded 25 pounds. They also noted that the house had hazards such as electrical cords or items that could result in a foreign body if swallowed or chewed, and that it wasn't a safe environment for the juvenile hyena in particular. So he was given a warning or violation about that. He posts photos of animals in his house, oftentimes the juvenile animals that I assume he is bottle feeding and hand raising to be more handleable. And with that, he'll post photos of them with his dogs, such as his German Shepherds, I believe also with his wolf hybrids, which he does breed, both of those, and sells. I recently found his personal Facebook page, which is, again, publicly accessible. And he has litters of German Shepherd puppies that he sells, as well as wolf hybrid puppies that he is currently selling.
Super happy to hear it.
Super great. Yep. Love that. Another one is that on July 2017, he had his first injury report where he gave the following statement, and I'm reading this verbatim. At approximately 6 p.m., July 10th, while in enclosure with Syrian bear, cleaning and giving treats, bear bit my butt. Nothing aggressive, not an attack or any mistreatment, simply a bite. I work hands-on with all my big cats and bears, no harm done other than a little recovery. This bite occurred after he had given Bruiser some treats and turned his back to give treats to Honey, which is the black bear that was in the same enclosure. Bruiser bit down on his left buttocks, and after he let go, Bovard was able to leave the enclosure, lock the doors behind him, and call a friend to take him to the hospital, where he received treatment for punctures and lacerations. Bovard described it as a frustration bite on his statement to law enforcement, and that Bruiser had only bitten him once before when he was a cub. Prior to this, there was no incident report other than that bite that occurred to that member of the public, which we're not sure which bear it was. The next injury happened May 10th, 2018, when he entered the enclosure of 6-year-old cougar Mayhem for morning cleaning. After 10 minutes of cleaning, the cougar became playful, so Bovard played with him for a few minutes before the cat became excited and began roughhousing. This caused Bovard to get injuries that required stitches from the ER. So the next one is the most recent and is, I believe, the most substantial. Bovard entered the enclosure housing 10-year-old bears Honey and Bruiser, and after dropping treats to allow him to enter the enclosure with their larger buckets of food, he entered, dumped the feed buckets, and then began to fix a piece of fencing that the bears had damaged. So he was working within the enclosure, which did not have a closeout gate or a safety entrance. So he was in with direct contact with the bears. As he was working, Bruiser finished his food and began approaching Bovard. Bruiser is, to quote Bovard, more active during the summer months and likes to play or wrestle. Bovard pushed Bruiser away so that he could continue repairs and turned away from him. Bruiser then bit him on the inner thigh, causing him to fall backwards, and Bruiser then released his leg and walked away to eat Honey's food. Wow. I think it's incredibly fortunate that Bruiser walked away. This really reminded me of that woman that you talked about in your last episode, where she entered the enclosure, tried to distract them with food to do something in the enclosure, and ended up getting mauled.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking of that case. And then I was also thinking of the man that I spoke about, Stefan, who, he had a bear that licked him and, according to the bear's owner, was roughhousing and it killed him. So, it only takes one time.
Exactly. And Syrian brown bears are big animals.
Yeah.
And this one bite was able to reach the muscle layer and damage the muscle layer. So Bovard had to have surgery. He was able to get out of the enclosure himself, lock the entrance, and then had to call a friend to transport him to the hospital. I believe an officer came by the next day to take his statement. And while he was taking this statement, Bovard said that he wanted to rehome Bruiser and 5 of the hybrid bear cubs, or bear cubs, I say. Most of them are adults now.
Mm-hmm.
He said that it was getting to be too much and that he shouldn't have let him breed so many times. I think that this is especially true now that he is divorced, and so he has one less person on staff 24/7 with him. Mm-hmm. And he's not getting any younger, and bears are no joke to take care of.
Yeah.
Especially when you don't have a lockout protocol or a safety enclosure for them. Mm-hmm. He did say that some friends are installing a guillotine-type door on Bruiser's enclosure so that he can be locked into the exercise yard, but that less bears would make it easier. Lieutenant C. Urban with Florida Fish and Wildlife is the one who took the statement, and he also reached out to other facilities that are licensed through them, and he found 2 suitable locations for some of the bears. But Bovard refused to rehome them because he does not like the individuals running the facilities.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I thought it was really nice of the officer to go out of his way to try and rehome these animals because Bovard asked him to. That is not one of the things that is in his job description.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Bovard turned that down.
Cool.
Yeah. So I'm going to move on to threats to animal health and well-being, which there are many. I would say most of the violations that he's received, both with USDA and Florida Fish and Wildlife, have been some sort of hazard towards the animal. This has included like a lot of issues with the enclosures, so rotting wood, exposed wire, broken latches, sagging fencing. A lot of the times there was issues with water. So, for example, at one point there was no water available to the otters. There was water so dirty that the inspector couldn't see the bottom of the container. There has been food that is left out or is contaminated. There's food that's been attracting ants and flies. So a lot of issues in just the enclosures themselves. But one of the biggest things recently within the last few months was that the USDA filed a report showing that Bovard has been falsifying veterinarian records. So USDA requires that there be an attending veterinarian for all of their facilities. Bovard has had one historically, one that actually rehomed her own personal cougar to him. That might have been Mayhem, because that's one of the few cougars that he has acquired as older, like as an adult. That veterinarian no longer works for him. And this is why. So these are all the claims that Bovard made. He said that an attending veterinarian had been contacted and examined a sick Jeffrey's cat who had generalized hair loss on the left side of its body and a squinting right eye. He claimed that the attending veterinarian conducted regular site visits that usually take about an hour. And this raised a red flag for the APHIS inspector because it took them over 2 hours to simply view all the animals on the property, not even to examine them. The attending veterinarian contradicted that claim and said that she was not contacted for annual visits and only consulted for the occasional animal wound or abnormality, of which she was not ever contacted for the Jeffrey cat. He also claimed that the attending veterinarian observed an obese male jaguar several times and suggested the solution was to cut back on his diet. This is in reference to Tank, obviously. The attending veterinarian disagreed with this, saying that she was called to the facility to evaluate an injured male lion, but never actually viewed Tank. Instead, Bovard mentioned it in passing that he believed the animal was overweight, and she suggested the first start would be to cut back on his health. She suggested that the first step would be to cut back on his diet, with no follow-up or examination. Bovard also claimed that he had reached out to facilities that owned Tank's siblings, and that they reported the siblings also had weight issues. So that's an interesting tidbit in regards to Tank specifically, because people are often quick to defend Safari Sammy and Bovard when it comes to Tank's weight. A lot of the fans will say, no, he's just built that way. Jaguars are a lot denser than leopards, and not quite the case.
Yeah, I've seen wild jaguars. They're not obese. They're just muscular. Like,
they're muscular.
It's very different.
Yes. So the attending veterinarian also stated that she had not been given a program of veterinary care to review and sign in over 2 years, during which time he had acquired a hyena and a population of prairie dogs. I'm not sure how many prairie dogs, but both of those are new species to him. And so USDA requires that there be a veterinary care plan and an enrichment plan and a nutrition plan signed and reviewed by the attending veterinarian for all new species acquired. So there was none for the spotted hyena and prairie dogs, despite Bovard claiming and presenting the USDA with a plan. So those were falsified documents. They also observed two geriatric tigers, which at the time was Bali and Amira, who were observed with ocular issues, neurological signs, and slim body weights, as you probably would with any, advanced age tiger. Bovard would not answer or did not respond when asked if he had discussed quality of life with the attending veterinarian. APHIS described, and I quote, a complete lack of communication with licensee and the attending veterinarian regarding proper veterinary care, nutritional and supplementation requirements, internal and external parasite control, and other aspects of animal care and use. They also stated that he does not have regularly scheduled visits and routinely disregards the attending veterinarian's medical advice. To give an example, Bovard contacted the attending veterinarian regarding a limping cougar, but did not bring the animal into the clinic when the veterinarian requested he do so. this veterinarian says that she has concerns regarding the ability for the facility to allow examinations because they do not have squeeze chutes, they do not have lockouts, and they do not have the ability to transport larger and more dangerous animals to the clinic for necessary veterinary care. So this was regarded as a direct violation.
I didn't even think of that.
One of the two. Yeah. So this was considered at the time of inspection a direct threat to animal health.
Yeah.
So wow. This was a pretty big violation. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised to see that this was not enough to revoke or even suspend his license.
Mm-hmm.
The falsification of veterinary records is something that is not a small infraction.
Mm-hmm.
But as of today, he is still licensed and his licensure is still active. So I will also add that inspections during October 2020 and May 2021 found that 14 deaths of animals were unrecorded, including the deaths of some fennec fox cubs. And a tiger was diagnosed with vitamin A deficiency in 2017 because it lacked feeding and nutrition plans. So there's some issues that are directly seen with endangering animal health, not just potentially endangering animal health, like with the enclosure issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we're talking about animals specifically, I want to talk about Jaws, who is the hyena that they currently have.
Yeah.
So Jaws is a female spotted hyena, not a male, as was previously said in the early announcements and how they talked about him or her earlier. So like my Twitter thread that I wrote references her as him, which if you go back to the hyena episode, like, there's a reason that it's not straightforward to...
There's a peen on everybody. Like, maybe they just weren't educated that female hyenas have pseudo-penises. That I can understand, but also...
Yes.
Maybe like, you figure own out a what hyena? You got. Yeah, maybe you exactly. should know that. Like,
you own one now? It should be one of those things that you know. So this... Jaws was residing in his house, as I mentioned earlier, which had hazards. I talked to Christine Wilkinson, Dr. Wilkinson, and she was wonderful enough to answer some questions for me, specifically about why spotted hyenas are bad pets. And I know that when Bovard talks about his animals and when Safari Sammy posts her animals, they talk about them as not being pets. But in every practical definition and in every way that they interact with these animals, they are being treated as pets. So that's why I refer to them as pets when talking about why should we not have a hyena as a pet? apart from the obvious in that you shouldn't have exotic large predators as pets, spotted hyenas have an extremely strong jaw, more so than lions and tigers. And that presents a pretty big threat, especially when you're putting your face right next to their mouth, which there are many photos available to the public of people doing just that. Mm-hmm. Even during COVID, which I mentioned prior, hyenas are vulnerable to COVID, and Jaws was allowed to interact with the public, some of whom were wearing masks, but most of whom were not wearing substantial or adequate masks.
Mm-hmm.
As a juvenile as well, so his immune system would not be fully developed.
Yep.
Specifically, when I talked to Dr. Wilkinson, I asked her about spotted hyenas and their sociability. Jaws was socialized with dogs, wolf hybrids, and some of the other collective animals that just reside in the house and around the house and on the property. Mm-hmm. You can find pictures of him being introduced through the fence to lions and tigers. But notably, she was not introduced or socialized around any other hyenas. Spotted hyenas, if you know anything about spotted hyenas, they are the most sociable of all hyenas. And they have really complex social structures, really complex social structures, specifically around the females of the clan. And so Dr. Wilkinson said that spotted hyenas are usually housed together in at least groups of two that she's seen in AZA facilities. Mm-hmm. And they are pretty reliant on social interaction. In particular, hyenas that are on display are really in need of that social dynamic with each other because solo hyenas tend to get particularly stressed. They also, at minimum, need the same space as bears and lions, which is about 300 to 350 square meters per two animals. The more space, the better, because large carnivores are wide-ranging animals, including hyenas. I do not have the details on the size of any of Bovard's enclosures. Mm-hmm. He has been cited in one newspaper article as saying that his enclosures are at least twice the size of the minimum requirement, which we've talked before, or at least you have on this podcast, about how the minimum standards are often not actually sufficient for animal welfare. Mm-hmm. This is probably the case here as well. He was in that same newspaper article was cited with a different facility in Florida that I can't remember the name of, but they said that their enclosures are at least 10 times the size. And I believe they're on something of 200 or something acres. Wow. Which is a big difference between Bovard's 10 acres.
Yeah, I'd be curious to like do the math out with 10. I'm not a math person at all, but yes. I'd be curious to do the math of like how many enclosures you could fit on 10 acres if you didn't include his own house.
Yes. And if anybody listening, yeah, if anybody listening is a math whiz, I will list the animals again for you really quick. We have 95 animals.
Oh.
And of those are 7 Syrian brown bears, including the hybrids, 5 cougars, 10 lions, 2 jaguars, 6 tigers, 1 striped hyena, and 1 North American black bear. So comment if you tend to, or if you calculate that out. But yeah, it's there's a finite amount of room, and he has a lot of large predators that are, as Dr. Wilkinson said, far-ranging. Jaws is currently housed alone in her enclosure. That said, the proximity of the enclosure to each other because of the limited space, it does mean that she does have some sort of interaction, just not with her own species. Hyenas also need a lot of consistent, varied enrichment, just like any large, intelligent carnivore species, which we have not seen a lot of that enrichment, at least documented on TikTok or Facebook. Hyenas also shouldn't be owned because they are highly active, very dangerous, and are very social and fare better with a clan. They also are not domesticated. And I think that this is something that cannot be repeated enough. None of these animals are domesticated, which means their needs are not met by being in captivity. Their needs are not met by interacting with humans. And when you see social media that has, you know, people interacting with these large animals, these large wild animals, or even just interacting with wild animals like raccoons and bears that are on their property that they're feeding, none of these animals are designed to be interacting with humans and to be benefiting from that interaction. When we talk about appropriate enrichment, even when you get these sanctuary animals, and I'm not referring to sanctuary animals at Bovard's place, I'm referring to sanctuaries like Wildcat Ridge or Wild Animal Sanctuary. These are places that are no contact, which means they do not interact with their animals without barriers and without safety measures in place. And I've seen people ask before, well, don't they miss the interaction that they had at their previous place because, you know, they were confiscated from an owner that maybe let them live in their house or that pet them and went into the enclosure and played with them? And the answer that I've seen most often is that these animals were getting enrichment through that. And it wasn't good enrichment, but it was enrichment. So through playing with people, by being petted, by being talked to, that is a form of enrichment. It's just not the appropriate enrichment for that species. And so when you have these animals that switch to these no contact facilities, they're given appropriate enrichment, maybe for the first time. And that substitutes that human enrichment. And so they don't suffer from a lack of contact. It's not the sad thing that it would be for a dog who grew up in, you know, a home where they were, you know, sleeping on the bed, and then suddenly they were transferred to an outdoor enclosure where they didn't have any human contact. That's not the same, because that's a domesticated species and this is not.
Yeah, there's a reason that they're domesticated, and it's because they're not wolves anymore. So yes. that's the bottom line to me. It's like, we domesticated them for a reason. We made them this way so that they'd be easier to handle and like us more. And then there's wolves. Then there's everything else that we didn't, for a good reason. And it should have stayed that way. So I also want to point out too, like, you know, you were talking about raccoons and stuff. I like to think that I'm pretty highly educated when it comes to animals. And I mentioned in our last episode, I'm taking a wildlife rehab class because I want to be a wildlife rehabilitator. Or I think maybe I mentioned that. I can't remember. Anyways, I'm doing that. And I learned, I used to work picking up dead raccoons. I learned literally last week, 90% of raccoons, I'm not sure if this was the state I was learning this in or in general, but I think they were talking generalized, 90% of them carry raccoon roundworm. I didn't know that. And raccoon roundworm lives naturally in the raccoon. Like, they have a normal life cycle, doesn't negatively affect the raccoon. In anything else, it goes to your brain.
Yes. So
90% of them have a worm that can go to your brain. And if you are rehabilitating raccoons, the only way you can get rid of the raccoon roundworm larva is to literally light the floor of their enclosure on fire. Because otherwise, oh my gosh, does not kill the larva. So just even little things like that, I'm like, people who have raccoons as pets probably don't know that. So you're giving it to your kids, yourself, your other pets. And what are the other things that, like, lions and tigers, bears, hyenas, whatever have that people don't know about because they're not actually supposed to have these animals and not educated, you know? So anyways, my quip with that.
Exactly. And I actually learned that about the raccoon brain worms from Jess in the Wild on Twitter, who you have had. And she has been great about educating me about those horrible things that I never wanted to know, but now I do. And like, anytime I'm on TikTok and if there's one person who feeds raccoons out of their kitchen window.
Oh my God.
And there's raccoon paw prints like all over the kitchen. And it's like, oh, the brain worms.
There's all that worm larva. Yeah. Yep.
Oh,
you have to light her kitchen on fire. Like, that is crazy.
Oh, and people just, and that's another red flag that you can look for when you're consuming content is, are proper protocols being taken for disease management? And even when you have these animals that are born in captivity and bred in captivity, like Bovard has, you don't know what they could be picking up from the environment. There's always that uncertainty with any animal.
Mm-hmm.
And having the public come in and potentially give diseases to these animals, that makes it even more unpredictable. So it's just, there's a lot of threats that come from the public interacting with wildlife and wildlife interacting with the public.
Yeah. And this is, I just want to remind everyone, like, the overarching theme of this episode is, like, when you are consuming this type of media, this is what's happening behind the scenes.
Yes.
That you may not realize, that as Safari Sammy, 3 million people follow her and those animals are suffering. Like, everything that you have said so far.
Seven million.
Oh my God, that's even worse. But like, there is documentation of these animals suffering. So I think this is a good point to cut this episode in half, maybe.
Yes, probably.
Okay. So we're going to come back with the second half to this and touch more on the rest of this and like the broader implications for like consuming this type of media.
Yes. I think that's a perfect point.
Yeah. So I will cut there and then we will I'll record like a separate outro, and then now we can go into like a part two if that works for you.
Yeah. And if you need to edit it and like shove some of this into the next episode, feel free. Because this will be like criminal charges and then me talking about like using media responsibly. So we're almost like kind of wrapping up, but you know me, I can talk about this media thing for a long time. And I think it deserves like more coverage.
But
I do want to like, when we start up, I want to emphasize, like, I'm not talking about this because I have some vendetta against Carl Bovard or Safari Sammy as a person. I am talking about this because this has the best documentation that I've been able to find of a very popular creator who has a lot of followers and a lot of views and a big fan following of, you know, monetized media content that has all these USDA violations, all these Florida Fish and Wildlife violations, all these documented issues that people can learn from and that people can take this, learn the, you know, what we talk about and then apply this to how they consume other media. So it's not a personal thing, Carl. It's just, you're a good example.
You're a good example of a very bad example.
Yes, exactly.
So, if you would like access to part two of this episode, you can go on Patreon right now and join at the $5 or $15 tier to get access to part two. Or, for the first time, I will be posting part two available for individual purchase. So that means you will not have to be a member of our Patreon. You can just buy the episode individually to get access to it early. But otherwise, part two of this episode will be coming out in 2 weeks, and you can get that on our main feed, or like I said, you can purchase it through Patreon, which you can access in the episode description link. Otherwise, thank you so much to Sofiane for doing all of this research, and thank you so much for all you did for part two as well. And I will link her Twitter thread explaining a lot of this research that she did in our episode description as well. But part two next week, we will be talking about animal attacks, including not the single Vision Inc. that we talked about, but we will cover another very unfortunate case of a similar organization that went very, very wrong and is now no longer an organization because of some of the horrible things that happened there. So tune in for that. Otherwise, you can find us on social media at Get It Alive Pod on Instagram, Get It Alive Podcast on Facebook, where I post recent attacks. Follow me on Twitter at The Angry Ologist. Follow us on TikTok at Get It Alive as well. And you can check out our website, getalivepodcast.com, where you can also get merch. And I will be posting for the very first time a blog for our website, where I will be posting relevant things to recent episodes. And Sofiane will also be writing a little something after the part two of this comes out, so that we can all read it and have access to how we can better consume social media content to better the organizations that post this kind of stuff. So check that out, getalivepodcast.com. Otherwise, thank you so much to my second grade husband, Josh Walsh, for making our intro music, and Jesse Walsh for all the editing. And I'll see you in 2 weeks for part two. Thanks.